Welcome to the Physics Teaching Podcast, the podcast for teachers of physics made by physics teachers.
Physics teachers like me, Thomas WP, a part-time, A-level mostly, teacher of physics.
And physics teachers like me, Robin Griffiths, a full-time teacher of physics all the way through from year 8 to year 13.
And we're not very pro this week, are we? This is our second major go after we both made small mistakes that cost us quite rather largely in yesterday's recording. But here we are again.
Yeah, I think we all have a bad day at the office, don't we? Never mind, we're here and we're still alive. And we're going with take two.
Take two. And you sound crystal clear to me. So I'm going to hack together tonight and last night. And so I don't think anyone will notice. But if you do, that's why. Perhaps you can play a game. Is that the first go? Is that the second go? Who knows? Anyhow, Robin, it's December is coming.
It is. It's just around the corner. In fact, actually, by the time this podcast airs, it will be December. And let's face it, none of you are ready for Christmas, are you? You've not got anything in yet. All your loved ones, what are they going to be? They're going to be sitting there looking up at you with those big, tearful Disney eyes on Christmas Day because you've got them nothing. Well, luckily, I think we have a solution.
We do have a solution. And people have already started buying our T-shirts as Christmas presents. I can exclusively reveal. And as I was starting to stack my secret presents in my secret present place in my office here, I discovered a vacuum cannon. There's one vacuum cannon left for sale. So if you want that, do go to our shop, the.physicsteachingpodcast.com/shop.
Yeah, nothing says Merry Christmas like a vacuum cannon.
It really doesn't.
A supersonic ping pong ball really does say everything you want about the festive season, doesn't it? Marvellous.
So we have reached episode 10. Episode 11, ways to teach ... magnetic fields. But before we go into that, we wanted to thank our lovely listener.
We did. Absolutely. Some fantastic responses we've had on Twitter this week and on the email. So thank you so much. First of all, William Pope, who obviously heard the podcast from 2 weeks ago when we were talking about how to answer extended writing questions. Thank you, William, for your tips.
Yes, thank you, William. We'll put links to that in the show notes. You actually linked us to the wrong resource, but we found your resource and we'll link to both in the show notes. And we're planning to do an episode on literacy because friend of the podcast, James De Winter, got in touch and we've done another Dispatches with De Winter about literacy.
This whole idea of literacy, I remember once I worked, actually it was a school we worked at together, Thomas, and our head of maths was also the head of literacy. And when he was challenged on this, saying sort of, why would the head of maths be head of literacy? And he said, well, it's really important in maths. The inability to pick apart maths questions is one of the big causes that a lot of kids don't do as well as they should do on their maths GCSE. So there definitely is literacy hidden away in all the subjects. And it's a great thing to talk about in the context of physics.
Yes, and one of the things William said was, it takes a brave person to pause at the start of a four-point question.
Yes, it takes a bold person to... I was trying to do the knight from Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Yeah. Bold person, only to write a couple of words in the first 4 minutes of a four-marker. But yes, it's a bold thing to do indeed, and very important. This is goes back to what we were talking about in terms of planning these responses before you start writing, because that can just a few seconds of planning can make all the difference between a mediocre answer and a good one.
And James has a lot to say about it, and that will be in a further podcast. And then we wanted to thank people who'd responded to our resources episode last week. Someone was reminded that Bernard Rand had started collecting resources, and there was a bit of a Twitter thread on that. So it'll be interesting to see how that progresses. He got a little bit down the road with Key Stage 3, but I think it kind of grew to a halt because, hey, teachers are busy.
Yeah, it's funny, actually, because we were talking about this and saying during the podcast episode, yeah, it's really difficult during the year to actually get any of these sort of ancillary things done, that they tend to fall off the bottom of the priority list. And Bernard's experience would tend to bear that out. It's just very, very difficult to find time, particularly during an even busier year, if anything, this year, to get those resources published.
Mm. And then I got overexcited. You've been teasing me about that.
Yes, I did like this. No, but it does look like a fantastic tool. So I'm teasing you a bit because, hey, it's you. But Auto Hotkey, tell us about this.
So I cannot tell you how I came to this, but I think it was something completely unrelated and geeky that I was doing. And I was looking at this thing, Auto Hotkey. It works in Windows. I haven't looked further than that. And it's a little script that runs in the background. And it's basically an application. You double-click it, it runs like an application. But the beauty of it is that you can completely customize what key combinations on your keyboard do. So the rarely used Windows Control combination or the Windows Alt Shift combination, you can customize them to do anything you want. And the beauty of it is it works in your whole operating system. So if you are typing a Teams message to a stuck sixth former and you want to do times 10 to the minus 19 on my computer, I can just do Control Windows E and that pops out. And I'm thinking, how many times do I type that a year? How many times do I type times 10 to the something a year? Just unbelievable amounts of time. I spent so much time copying and pasting from subscript and superscript websites. So now I can just do Win Shift 1 for superscript 1, and I can do Control Win 1 for subscript 1. And I've got subscript, the word total, which is Control Win T, and the possibilities, I haven't even begun to explore them. My theory is I put on the resources site the script that I'm using, and we have a physics teacher's auto hotkey script that we share, and it just becomes part of the armory. I'm just blown away with the possibilities.
Yeah, I mean, it does sound good. I can hear the gasp and the intake of breath from physics teachers across the country. Think, no more having to type in meters per second squared.
Exactly that. It's just crazy how much you can do with it. And the scripting language is incredibly simple, and yeah, it's well documented and it's free.
There you go. It's linked to it in the show notes, people. So if you fancy having a go at this, we will publish all the information and Thomas's scripts as well.
Yes, auto hotkey. Just Google it. It's just brilliant. And one more thing I wanted to talk about was the Typer's book that James De Winter mentioned. Now, I followed the link in the show notes that gives a small donation to the podcast, but you do have to go through Amazon. And I went out and bought that, Robin.
Me too. I think we both did.
Has it come yet?
Well, yes, absolutely. I've got it and been leafing through it. I'm very excited by the questions in there. It looks really, really good.
The questions are great. I'm very excited about it. I was a bit disappointed there are no answers. So you're going to get a few calls from me just because I have this imposter syndrome about my physics being a half engineer. So you may get calls saying, Robin, page 364.
Yes, well, I think it's quite good fun. I mean, it certainly will get a bit of professional dialogue going. I think we'll all be having arguments about work, about which one the right order is. But I'm also going to have a delve around in there and see if there's potentially a website or somewhere where you can access the answers if you register as a teacher. Sometimes books work that way, don't they? So.
Yes, but if you find that, let me know and we'll let the beloved listener know.
Absolutely.
Anyway, on with the show. Ways to teach ... magnetism.
Mm.
Firstly, thank you so much for the many, many, many ideas that came to us. Brilliant.
Absolutely. We got a huge number of tweet responses. I would say we got a huge number of voice messages on the was it the Instagram or the WhatsApp or whatever it is, but unfortunately we didn't.
Got one. We got one email with the voice message.
We got one email with the voice message, but it was recorded onto an MP3, to be fair. And,
but that's the same. That's the same. Thanks. That's the same. Thanks.
Absolutely, yeah. And so we've got loads of great, great tips. So thank you so much. It's really good. Where are we going to start?
Well, I think firstly we should say thank you for all the suggestions about electromagnetism. But if we covered that as well, the podcast would be far too long. We'll have to build that into our ways to teach ... schedule. We're just going to stick with magnetic fields and describing magnetism.
That's a great plan.
I very much got in mind the non-specialist here because it's exactly the sort of thing a non-specialist is going to teach is magnetic fields to 11-year-olds, 12-year-olds.
Yeah, and this is the thing. It's that cold sweat. I mean, I remember teaching biology and chemistry as a non-specialist. And when you get that question, whatever the sort of the equivalent of what is a magnetic field in chemistry and biology might be, you know, like the famous one was, what were the name of the receptors in the nose called? You know, I made up smell buds because I was panicking. It is that sort of cold sweat panic. You go, I've got no idea. So that's what we're going to try and answer for you today, hopefully, if you are one of our heroic and special teachers.
Yeah, so I tweeted out, because we had a lot of suggestions for demos and practicals, which are great, but what I really wanted to hear was what the listener thought about how do you describe it to a 12-year-old. So I just thought we'd just go through what people said, and then we can mull it over as we go. So going through them as I see them on Twitter, Gingerbeard Physics at Physics Ginger said a region around a magnet where magnetic materials experience a force.
Our textbook. That's exactly what I would say.
Yeah, I like the word region there.
Yes, because a lot of people say area, and I don't like area because area is kind of implies two dimensions, and it can cause a bit of confusion when you start doing pressure. So I quite like the use of the word region. It implies it's a three-dimensional space.
Yes, and Gingerbit Physics says, demo the 3D nature of the field using a magnetism tube, which is in Shore Magnets in Rapids online catalogue. Yeah, I think I like the idea of demonstrating 3D. We'll come on to that because a lot of the things people have suggested are 2D fields. Then Rich Wrigley, R. Wrigley, said, an area where a magnetic material or something with a charge will feel a force. So he's extended it a bit and he's put something with a charge. Would you say charge for year eight?
I'd probably stick with magnetic material there because, I mean, to be honest, we don't even really at Key Stage 4 get into the idea that it's charges that cause the magnetic effects as well as the electric effects. So,
I think I'd avoid that for the younger kids. And then friend of the podcast, Joe Moore, says, I've seen an analogy to smell. It's also invisible and the smell is strongest closer to the source. But she then says she finds that most kids are familiar with magnets from primary schools, good old primary schools. So have you heard that analogy before?
I've never heard it, the analogy of smell, but it's quite a nice one, isn't it? It's this idea that it will get weaker as you go further away from it. And it kind of stands to reason. It intuits like that. So I quite like that.
Joe Rowing says it's hard to fit into one tweet and runs for the hills, but he does. He then comes back. He takes a deep breath and he says, a field, a model to give us a way of understanding and describing how some things interact. If a magnet is involved in interacting with, e.g. a steel ball, we say it's within a magnetic field. Field lines are diagrams where we draw imaginary lines to show the effects of this field.
That's very nice. So that's sort of taking it up a level. So that's moving on from just the neat definition into an explanation there.
Yeah.
And quality of that explanation is really nice. So thanks for that, Joe. That's a good one. Love it.
Yeah, and I like the idea of starting to talk about the field lines show the effects of the field, because when we come onto the iron filings and what do they actually show, is it... there's not lines, are there? And it's trying to get across they're not lines. It's a field. It's a region that where a force is experienced that we express through the medium of lines. There aren't lines in space that are the field.
Absolutely. It's a series of basically vector lines, but obviously you wouldn't say that to a 12 or 13-year-old, but it is exactly what the field lines are. They are the way that, and it is, and somebody said this, it's the way that a minute piece of pure north would travel. It's the direction that a minute piece of pure north pole would travel if such a thing were possible, which it isn't.
Yeah, I don't want to go down monopoles. David Cotton, friend of the podcast, he shares a link to a YouTube video and has a definition very similar to what we've said. But then he says something wonderful, which is definitely don't ask Feynman. And he links to a video of Feynman being asked what magnetic fields are or what magnetism is. I think I'll play a clip in here.
If you get hold of two magnets and you push them, you can feel this pushing between them. Turn it around the other way and they slam together. Now, what is it, the feeling between those two magnets?
What do you mean, what's the feeling between the two magnets?
There's something there, isn't there? I mean, the sensation is that there's something there when you push these two magnets together.
Listen to my question. What is the meaning when you say that there's a feeling? Of course you feel it. Now, what do you want to know?
What I want to know is what's going on. Between these two bits of metal.
Magnets repel each other.
And, well, then what does that mean, or why are they doing that, or how are they doing it? I must say, I think that's a perfectly reasonable question.
Of course
it's
a reason. It's an excellent question. Okay? But the problem that you're asking, you see, when you ask why something happens, how does a person answer why something happens?
So, Robin, when I was looking at the Feynman clip, it was really hard to pull out a short bit that I've just played. So what do you think? Shall we play the whole interview at the end of the podcast after the music?
That's a nice idea. Yeah, the whole of that Feynman interview there. It's always worth listening to Richard Feynman.
You can never have too much Feynman. Okay, so we'll put it back in there. Back to us last night.
I do love Feynman. You do get these things of, you can't possibly understand that. Get out of town. He did that with quantum field theory as well, which is rather nice. But anyway, I think he was right with that one.
Yeah, but then he just goes on and just you can just listen to him talking forever. Goodness me.
Yeah, I know. He's superb.
There's so many people came up with a description that really is, it's a place where a magnetic object feels a force. I really like it. And I think I like Mark Robinson at Mark_Rubbo. It is a special region of space. And he says, gesture, give relatable answers. and discuss descriptions. And what makes this region special is that in this space, certain objects experience a force.
I love that. Mark sounds like a proper theatrical teacher, which is great. Yeah. It is a special region of space. I love it. Wave your arms around, sit in there, a bit of passion. Great.
And then he follows up and says, you can make it relatable and fun. Imagine the cafeteria is the region, and in this region, coats experience a strong pull to the middle of the room. Ask them about it. Get them to invent their own, and then apply it to real physics examples. I love that.
I love the idea of that, making the room into a field and say, you know, sort of everybody with a blue coat is a North Pole and everybody with a red coat is like a South Pole. So which way are you going to go? And that kind of, that's really nice. I do like that.
So I think we've got there, haven't we? That we like the word region. Mm. It's a region of space where a magnetic material will experience a force.
Yeah, and that's opens a little bit of a can of worms, because magnetic material, there is a difference there, and that there's a subtlety there about the fact that your ferromagnetic materials that aren't themselves magnets still experience a force because they are become induced magnets and so on and so forth. So that's a jumping off point for some more complexity. But
yeah, but I think the jumping off point with the younger kids here would be showing that region, then we get on to the ways we show a magnetic field.
Yes.
So, I mean, the when you look at the replies there, a lot of people are huge fans of the iron filings. And before we do that, I feel we should do our health and safety announcement, Robin.
Yes, absolutely. Health and safety, very important. A CLEAPS announcement, I believe.
Yes, a CLEAPS announcement. So, non-specialists, iron filings, kids should wear goggles because from CLEAPS, avoid contact with eyes, e.g. do not rub eyes with contaminated fingers. Iron oxidizes rapidly in a saline environment and can cause severe irritation.
Yes, the iron filings are sharp. They're sharp little pieces, and in the same way that you wouldn't want to get a piece of sand in your eye, iron filings are a lot worse. So, yes, goggles are essential, and advise the kids to not touch their eyes, to wash their hands before they leave the room or when they finish the practical.
I also found, I think this is the American equivalent, a material safety data sheet, MSDS. Check for and remove any contact lenses. In case of contact, immediately flush eyes with plenty of water for at least 20 minutes and get medical attention if irritation occurs. Yeah, you must. I love this use of goggles because they always think it's about acid bursting into their face. But no, this is stopping you rubbing your eyes, just reminding you. I love that use of goggles.
Yes, absolutely. Because, I mean, as we will know during this COVID thing, it's been pointed out, isn't it? We all inadvertently touch our face however many times it is a minute because we're just used to doing it, and the same goes with your eyes. You know, your eye itches, you rub it, and if your hands are covered in iron filing, it's not good.
So now we've saved everyone's eyes, let's talk about how we visualize a magnetic field.
So visualizing the magnetic field, there's a tip I would give. If you're working with a magnet and iron filings, make your technician's day by wrapping your magnet with cling film before you start. Because whatever happens, iron filings do tend to get on the magnet, and they are an absolute pig to get off once they've got actually attached to the magnet. So if you put some cling film around the outside, that's a good way of keeping the magnet clean.
It is a good tip, and I take measures to stop my magnets coming near the iron filings too. I liked Ms. Dannon at BCHS at Ms_D_Psi, and she just says, this needs to be demonstrated to the students. Seeing is believing. I think that's lovely.
Absolutely, it really is. And there's some great variations on the basic theme. So the basic one that I was always taught to do was just piece of paper on top of the magnet, sprinkle on your iron filings, which we helpfully have in old salt pots, you know, pepper pots or whatever they are, so that you can sprinkle them on, and then you tap the paper lightly. And lo and behold, the iron filings arrange themselves into lines following the magnetic field lines.
Absolutely. And I really liked Physics Mama Alicia, who, friend of the podcast, at Physics Mama, who says, rather than magnet under paper, I demo using magnets under a Perspex safety screen I steal from a chemist. Put it on books and then put the iron filings on the screen. You can see the magnet and the field together, and you can get more than one magnet under there.
Yes, that's a really lovely tip. I think that's just so simple, isn't it? Such a simple variation. Just change it for Perspex. And I suspect, you know, after our vaccine comes in, there'll be quite a lot of Perspex screens going spare. So you should be able to lay your hands on one, hopefully.
You should be able to. I should imagine she puts white paper underneath it so you can visualise it. And I like the idea of using more than one magnet. And I like the fact you can tap it and the whole thing will shake. So I think that's a really good idea. At Corsham Science, Science TCS, says, yes, I found the mini whiteboards are really quite good too, as you can also draw on them. I like that idea, but you can't see the magnet, can you, because you'd put it underneath.
No, that's true. But I suppose you could draw on the Perspex with ball pens. There'd be no problem with that, would there?
Yeah, exactly. But the whole thing about the Perspex I like is that you can see the magnet underneath.
So one of the things I always think that's a bit of a danger of this demo is the idea that you, and hence my reluctance to use the term area, that the kids can walk away thinking this only happens in two dimensions, in the flat plane of the paper. But of course, it's three-dimensional. And perhaps the Perspex screens might be able to help there. If you've got two and sprinkled iron filings on both, ooh, one above the other, maybe that could give you a way of showing the iron filing spreads up, or the magnetic field spreads up into the third dimension as well.
Three, four, five. There'll be so much lying around after COVID. I liked Anthony Clouser at Mr. Clouser. He said, it may seem very old-fashioned, but I'm still a big fan of magnets and iron filings on an OHP. It's like a sim, but real. Over the years, it's been quite a battle to stop others from throwing my OHP out. Well, I'm afraid, Anthony, I lost that battle. We don't have an OHP anymore. There was one when I started at the school, but it has gone.
Yeah, Anthony's... keep hold of that OHP. They're so good for so many things, including the impromptu ripple tank, which we'll probably do another day.
And one more thing that I want to talk about is at PhysTech, physics technician, I think, who photocopied different iron filing patterns of his magnet and then copied the photocopies onto acetate. I'm guessing so he could then put on his OHP, or I guess on he could scan them, and then if you layer them up one after the other, what do you see? You see that field lines don't exist.
Yes, they're just because the iron filings themselves are becoming magnetized, of course, they that's why they line up. But in reality, there's no such thing as a real field line in space.
Yes, and I think it'd be interesting. I guess it would eventually, if you did it with the lots and lots and lots, it would go black because they'd just be randomly placed. But you'd see kind of the mirage of the shape of the field. I don't know, but I like the idea getting across that the lines just are a way of thinking about the field, not the field is made of lines.
Which goes to Joe Rowing's point when he said that it's a representation, it's a model of the field that we're representing there with the field lines.
Excellent. I was surprised, Robin, that no one mentions what I use, which is, I'll tell you how I use iron filings in a bit, but I use plotting compasses.
Of course.
I've had trouble ordering plotting compasses because sometimes I get, the compasses for drawing circles, so they have a special name, don't they?
Pairs of compasses.
Yes, that's it. Pairs of compasses. I ordered plotting compasses before and then got a whole tray of stuff to draw circles with. It wasn't great.
I've done that before, absolutely. Wendy, a technician who we both worked with, our technician, I once ordered compasses because I wanted something to draw circles with, and she religiously gave me the tray of plotting compasses, and I said, oh, and she said, I think you meant pairs of compasses, didn't you? It's like, yep, score one to you, Wendy, that's it.
Well, I draw them, so I get the right thing. But so when I get my tray of plotting compasses, we've only got about 15, because they're one of those high-value things that tend to go missing. You really have to count them back. But I like to use them, and I give one to each pair, and I train them to plot a magnetic field with a plotting compass, because you can do it. If you draw a dot where the north is pointing and then move the south pole onto that dot and then draw a dot where the north is pointing and then move the south pole onto that dot and then draw the dot where the north is pointing and then join the dots.
So you start off at the one end of the magnet and the arrow is pointing away from the magnet, so you
exactly, and then you put a dot on there, and then you move it forward.
Tailor the arrow onto that point, and then carry on going.
Yes,
good. Got you. That's good.
And you get fantastic results. I always use that with sixth form when I start teaching about magnets to do the magnetic field.
Yeah, no, very nice. That is a nice idea, and I think I have used them when, you know, putting them next to a wire and turning the current on and off, and you see the compass arrow flick, so you can definitely see the idea of magnetism there. So that's a really nice one. Mapping the actual magnetic field in two dimensions with your plotting compasses.
But I'll tell you, the way I show 3D fields with iron filings, because you can get the kids to do it. I obviously, because I'm not as intelligent as Alicia, I use paper on books with the magnet underneath. But I say that it's a 3D region. So if you're very careful, you can build towers and you can build three-dimensional. If you sprinkle them on the poles, they will build the start of the loops going out into space in 3Ds. And then they have little competitions to see who can build the highest tower. That's fun. And they can make the tower, you know, centimetre long, maybe a bit further. That's great fun.
That's very nice. I mean, ferromagnetic liquids I've seen. I've never actually seen one in the flesh. I don't know how expensive they are or if there's something you can lay hands on. But ferromagnetic liquids themselves, if you can put those in a little plastic beaker and put a magnet underneath it, sort of end on so it's on top of the pole, you'll see some nice patterns there.
Yeah, it's the staple of Hollywood for showing something weird, like an alien thing, is a magnet under a table with ferromagnetic liquid on it. Have you seen that? I've seen that so many times.
I wonder if you can find a recipe online for making ferromagnetic liquid. That'll be a good one. If I find that, dear listener, I will put that on the show notes too. Make your own.
Now, another way of visualizing, I guess this is like plotting compasses, is using your mobile device. So one is Firefox, which Mark Wally, a friend of the podcast, taught us about, but also Rich Wrigley, the random physicist at R. Wrigley, he suggested one I'd not heard of, Arduino Science Journal, which does very much the same thing. Now, Mark Wally was kind enough to email us an MP3 of him telling us about how he uses Firefox. Now, it's a little bit electromagnetism-y, but it's really interesting, so I'm going to play it now.
So I suppose the first thing is, well, what is Firefox? Well, it's a free app that uses sensors on your phone to measure various quantities. And this interface allows you to record these quantities over time. And depending on your phone, you may be able to record sound, pressure, magnetic field strength, and so on. And you can get the app from your usual app store. I'm just going to talk a little bit about the magnetometer. So with the magnetometer in your phone and using Firefox, you can get triaxial measurements of magnetic field strength. The magnetometer in my phone is located somewhere in the top left-hand corner of the phone, so that's worth bearing in mind. And I thought I'd just mention a couple of uses. So, for instance, we all do that experiment, don't we, investigating the strength of an electromagnet, and we use the not-too-famous unit of magnetic field strength, the paperclip. But if we want to take that a stage further and become a little more quantitative, we could use Firefox. So as long as we ensure that our phones are kept in exactly the same position, and that if we increase the number of turns on the coil or changing the voltage, that we place the coil back in the same place each time, we can measure the field strength in Teslas rather than in terms of paper clips. So that's one use I think is really nice, and it's a little bit more physicsy than just using paper clips. The other measurement I like to use the magnetometer for is to measure magnetic dip. Many of us will have seen the old triaxial compasses where the needle will align along the magnetic field, but you can do it nicely using your mobile phone. So the way to do it is place your phone on a flat surface and select magnetometer. And then you'll see a range of ways in which the data can be presented along the top of the display. And you want to tap on simple to get just the triaxial values. It gets rid of the time axis, in truth. And then hit the play button. So whilst it's lying on the surface, turn the phone until the X component goes to zeros. Because when you've done that, what you're in fact doing is aligning the phone towards the north magnetic pole. Once that's done, then start lifting the bottom end of the phone so that it pivots against the top edge of the phone. And you'll notice that the Z component starts to drop in magnitude, and keep on lifting it until it gets to zero. As soon as it gets to zero, making sure that the X component is still zero, your phone is aligned along the magnetic field. And so if you've got a protractor to hand, you're able to actually measure the magnetic dip. The other final thing I occasionally like to do, and this is quite good fun, you can actually measure simple harmonic motion using the magnetometer. And the way I do this in my garden, I've got a swing seat, and I've sat on there with Firefox and place it on the magnetometer setting and just swing backwards and forwards. And actually, I get a sine wave, and it's showing that clearly as my swing seat is going backwards and forwards, and it's cutting through the magnetic field in a slightly different orientation, it's able to measure it. So anyway, VFox is just an absolutely magnificent app, and it's got so much capacity for physics. And it's great when looking at magnetism and electromagnetism.
Oh, good old Mark. Fantastic. That's really, really interesting. And of course, I'd forgotten, completely forgotten Firefox. And phones have a magnetometer in them. I'm not sure I ever knew that, because I knew about Firefox and I've been using it a few times, but I didn't know it had a magnetometer in there. So that's an excellent one. And of course, I love the tip at the end there, on a swing, detecting the Earth's magnetic field. Brilliant.
Yes, I love that. And I love the idea, and I'm thinking I'm going to do this now, of whilst we're talking, actually, of finding the angle of the Earth's magnetic field, which I think
Yes. Calls
a dip. I've never heard that term before. But the way he describes it, it's measuring the angle at which the magnetic field is coming in through the building. So I just think that's fascinating.
Yeah, this is it. I mean, the magnetic field lines don't necessarily hit the Earth's surface at right angles. So you can get this idea of a slight dip on your magnetic field reading.
Sorry, Robin, what were you saying? I was playing with my phone.
Yes.
Sorry.
Phones away, please. Thank you.
I'll do that later. I'll do that later. So what else have we got? I'm sure someone mentioned, but I haven't yet. I can't remember where. Sorry if you mentioned this. We have to do the levitating paperclip. And I think that's what I'd start with the younger kids.
Yeah, I would say if you describe the starter, then I'll describe the plenary that I do as well.
Perfect. So I would introduce the levitating paperclip, which is a paperclip. You blue tack it to the bottom of a retort stand, and it's attached to a piece of cotton, and it's got a paperclip on the end. And then you clamp a magnet. And if you do it right, you can hold the magnet, and it sits, you know, 5 or 6 mil below the magnet. So it's levitating. Like magic.
So you've got the paperclip sort of hanging in midair, held by the cotton to the desk, which is
by magic,
tapped down with a bit of blue tack.
And then they have a whole range of materials, and they have to see what can interfere with the magnetic field. And that's a way of finding the magnetic material. So they put a bit of wood in and nothing happens, and they put their protractor in and nothing happens, and then they put a piece of steel in and the paperclip falls, or the piece of steel sticks to the magnet or something, and they can learn not all metals make the paperclip fall, and it's a good introduction to iron, cobalt, nickel are magnetic materials and interact with the magnetic field. And then that goes on to how it would then do the iron filings after that. So what is this region where magnetic materials experience a force? Let's have a look at it. Let's have a look at the field. So, Robin, what's your plenary for this?
I do love that. There's a touch of the magician about the kind of the suspended paperclip, isn't there? There's a touch of the magic of sort of pushing things. It's like when they levitate the magician's assistant and they sort of take the hoop over and sort of pass it up and down. It's kind of a bit like that, isn't it? It's quite nice. So, yeah, my plenary actually is a slightly different one. It's a bit of a puzzle that we give them at our school. And it does depend on having the right pieces of equipment. But if you can engineer it, it works quite well. So basically you have three pieces of metal, two of which are magnets and one of which is a piece of ferromagnetic material. And the challenge is for the students to identify which ones are which. They've got to work out which ones are the magnets and which one is just a piece of iron that's the same shape and size as the magnets. And that's the challenge for them. And of course, the trick is, how do they identify them, Thomas?
Well, I'm going to say, Robin, only magnets repel.
Exactly. So the like poles of the magnets will repel, whereas the ferromagnetic material will always be attracted to the magnets. So it's quite a nice little plenary just to get them to explain that. If they can put that understanding into words, then you know they've done pretty well with the learning of the magnetic fields and the jargon.
Yeah, it's a lovely challenge. Now, I realise we have forgotten to mention the one that I didn't know before this, and I really want to try, which again came from David Cotton. I've never seen this. He shares a picture of his old textbook, his old O-level textbook, and it's a bar magnet just resting on the side of a beaker, and there's quite a lot of water in the beaker, and then there's a long magnetised needle which is shoved through a cork with most of it under the water like an iceberg. And then you put that magnetized needle to float in the water, and it will trace around the magnetic field line. Beautiful.
Oh, very nice.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I have heard of the floating needle thing as well. And of course, students can make that needle themselves by stroking happily a nice metal needle with their permanent magnet. That's a nice way to do it as well.
Oh, that reminds me. I got in trouble when I was new into teaching. How do you stop a piece of iron being a magnet, Robin?
You bash it with a hammer.
Yeah. So I didn't have a class set of hammers, and I wanted to reduce the. I wanted to demagnetize my iron bars I'd ordered for the lesson, so I hit upon whacking the clamp stands. It's quite noisy. I got complaints.
I'll bet you did. Not least from the chemist. Why are all my clamp stands bent?
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend that. That was fun and very noisy, which is kind of how I teach sometimes. But it probably wasn't best for my colleagues down the corridor.
Fun and very noisy is the only way to teach physics, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I did the role play for kinetic theory with my year sevens the other day. That was fun and noisy. Took them as far away from the school buildings as I could. I still got. I'd made two paddles that were red and blue for hotter and colder, and I still got accused of being an air traffic controller when I came in later. So I was spotted.
You have been spotted. Yes.
Anyway, well, I think we should wrap it up there, Robin. Thank you so much, everyone, for your contributions.
Yeah, and thanks indeed to all of the people that we didn't get round to mentioning your contribution. We had so many this week. We'd never have got them all included in the podcast. So please, please, please don't let that put you off at replying to future tweets and getting in touch with the podcast. We will get everybody on eventually.
And for the next Ways to Teach episode, which we haven't yet decided what it'll be, I should think we'll leave electromagnetism to maybe episode 20, and we'll try and screw ourselves back to the previously published routine of every fifth episode.
So we're going to be doing episode 15 on a Ways to Teach.
I hope so. I mean, I muddled up episode 7 with episode 8 in the first 10 this season, so who knows? But well, we'll aim for 15. This is 11.
You should have seen my mock marking. All the students, you've added it up wrong. You've got this one wrong. Yes, I'm exactly like that. I can't count. But if you've got an idea that you'd like to hear on Ways to Teach, if there's something that you're thinking, God, I've got that coming up. It's on the scheme. It's sitting there glaring at me and I don't know what to do. Please do let us know. We'll include it as a Ways to Teach episode in about 4 episodes' time.
So you can email us, contact@thephysicsteachingpodcast.com, and you can email us attaching an MP3.
Yes, indeed. Or you can get in touch with us on Twitter @PhysicsTP.
Or Instagram, physics_teaching_podcast.
Oh, and don't forget, there's a contact form on every single page of the website, the.physicsteachingpodcast.com.
There is indeed. Well, that's us for this week, Robin. So thank you, dear listener, for all your ideas. And for sorry to the people who, as Robin said, who didn't get mentioned. And thank you very much, Robin.
Thanks, Thomas. See you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Physics Teaching Podcast. And special thanks this week to all the dear listeners who suggested ideas. Thank you so much. And also specifically to Mark Wally, who emailed us with an MP3. The podcast is presented by me, Thomas W.P., and Robin Griffiths, and produced and edited by me, Thomas W.P., with Robin doing the show notes. Thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you next week.
If you get hold of two magnets and you push them, you can feel this pushing between them. Turn it around the other way and they slam together. Now, what is it, the feeling between those two magnets?
What do you mean, what's the feeling between the two magnets?
There's something there, isn't there? I mean, the sensation is that there's something there when you push these two magnets together.
Listen to my question. What is the meaning when you say that there's a feeling? Of course you feel it. Now, what do you want to know?
What I want to know is what's going on between these two bits of metal.
The magnets repel each other.
And, well, then what does that mean, or why are they doing that, or how are they doing it?
I must say,
I think that's a perfectly reasonable question.
Of course it's a reason. It's an excellent question. Okay. But the problem that you're asking, you see, when you ask why something happens, how does a person answer why something happens? For example, Aunt Minnie is in a hospital. Why? Because she slipped. She went out and she slipped on the ice and broke her hip. That satisfies it, people. It satisfies, but it wouldn't satisfy someone who came from another planet, knew nothing about things. First, you should understand why, when you break your hip, do you go to the hospital? how do you get to the hospital with the, when the hip was broken? Well, because her husband, seeing that she had the hip was broken, called the hospital up and sent somebody to get her. All that is understood by people. Now, when you explain a why, you have to be in some framework that you allow something to be true. Otherwise, you're perpetually asking why. Why did the husband call up the hospital? Because husband is interested in his wife's welfare. Not always. Some husbands aren't interested in their wife's welfare when they're drunk and they're angry. And so you begin to get a very interesting understanding of the world and all its complications. In order to if you try to follow anything up, you go deeper and deeper in various directions. For example, you could go, well, why did she slip on the ice? Well, ice is slippery. Everybody knows that. No problem. But you ask, why is ice slippery? That's kind of curious. Ice is extremely slippery. It's very interesting. You say, how does it work? You could either say, I'm satisfied that you've answered me. Ice is slippery. That explains it. Or you could go on and say, why is ice slippery? And then you're involved with something, because there aren't many things as slippery as ice. It's very hard to get greasy stuff, but that's sort of wet and slimy. But a solid that's so slippery? Because it is in the case of ice that when you stand on it, they say, momentarily the pressure melts the ice a little bit, so you got a sort of instantaneous water surface on which you're slipping. Why on ice and not on other things? Because ice expands when it, water expands when it freezes, so the pressure tries to undo the expansion and melts it. Is capable of melting it. But other substances contract when they're freezing, and when you push them, they're just as satisfied to be solid. Why does water expand when it freezes and other substances don't expand when they freeze? All right? I'm not answering your question, but I'm telling you how difficult a why question is. You have to know what it is that you're permitted to understand and allow to be understood and known, and what it is you're not. You'll notice in this example that the more I ask why, it gets interesting after a while. That's my idea, that the deeper a thing is, the more interesting it is. And we could even go further and say, why did she fall down when she slipped? That has to do with gravity. It involves in all the planets and everything else. Never mind. It goes on and on. Now, when you ask, for example, why two magnets repel, there are many different levels. It depends on whether you're a student of physics or an ordinary person that doesn't know anything or not. If you're somebody who doesn't know anything at all about it, all I can say is that there's a magnetic force that makes them repel and that you're feeling that force. And you say, but that's very strange because I don't feel kind of force like that in other circumstances. When you turn them the other way, they attract. There's a very analogous force, electrical force, which is the same kind of a question. And you say, that's also very weird. But you're not at all disturbed by the fact that when you put your hand on the chair, it pushes you back. But we found out by looking at it that that's the same force, as a matter of fact, the electrical force, not magnetic exactly in that case, but it's the same electrical repulsions that are involved in keeping your finger away from the chair, because everything's made out of its electrical forces in minor and microscopic details. There's other forces involved, but this is connected to electrical forces. It turns out that the magnetic and the electric force with which I wish to explain these things, this repulsion in the first place, is what ultimately is the deeper thing that we have to start, that we can start with, to explain many other things that looked like they were, everybody would just accept them. You know, you can't put your hand through the chair. That's taken for granted. But that you can't put your hand through the chair, when looked at more closely, why it involves these same repulsive forces that appear in magnets. The situation you then have to explain is why in magnets it goes over a bigger distance than ordinarily. And there it has to do with the fact that in iron, all the electrons are spinning in the same direction. They all get lined up, and they magnify the effect of the force until it's large enough at a distance that you can feel it. But it's a force which is present all the time and very common, and is in a basic force of almost, I mean, I can go a little further back if I were more technical, but at an early level, I just have to tell you that's going to be one of the things you'll just have to take as an element in the world, the existence of magnetic repulsion or electrical attraction, magnetic attraction. I can't explain that attraction in terms of anything else that's familiar to you. For example, if we say the magnets attract like as if they were connected by rubber bands, I would be cheating you. Because they're not connected by rubber bands, I shouldn't be in trouble. you'd soon ask me about the nature of the band. And secondly, if you were curious enough, you'd ask me why rubber bands tend to pull back together again, and I would end up explaining that in terms of electrical forces, which are the very things that I'm trying to use the rubber bands to explain, so I have cheated very badly, you see. So I'm not going to be able to give you an answer to why magnets attract each other, except to tell you that they do, and to tell you that that's one of the elements in the world of the different kinds of forces. There are electrical forces, magnetic forces, gravitational forces, and others, and those are some of the parts. If you were a student, you'd go. I could go further. I could tell you that the magnetic forces are related to the electrical forces very intimately, that our relationship between the gravity forces and electrical forces remains unknown, and so on. But I really can't do a good job, any job, of explaining magnetic force in terms of something else that you're more familiar with, because I don't understand it in terms of anything else that you're more familiar with.